We are once again very close to the start of the deer harvest out at Short Hills Provincial Park, and we've got some guests joining us in the studio. Chester Gibson is a master's student at Brock University and also a representative of the Haudenosaunee Wildlife and Habitat Authority. He is the coordinator of the harvest out at Short Hills and will be filling us in on how that's going this year and the plans they have for that. Also joining us is Rochelle Friesen. She is the Canadian coordinator of the Christian Peacemaker team. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
For people who are not familiar with the hunt, can you tell us a little bit about why it's in Short Hills and generally how it came to be?
Well, I like the idea that you said harvest at the start, because hunt is kind of a Western kind of philosophy. As Indigenous people, we have ceremonies that we have throughout the year. And a lot of our diet is dependent on us being able to get enough deer for our community and our ceremonies. Why Short Hills? Well, it's within our hunting area in terms of the 1701 and the Dish With One Spoon Belt. Like the Wildlife and Habitat Authority takes safety as number one, right? So I mean, there was a time when people had mentioned for us to go harvesting at different other areas, one of them being the Red Hill Creek area. And we went in there. There was a crew of us from the Habitat Authority, and we did an assessment in there. And it's just determined it was way too dangerous, right? There's too many people using, too many access entrance points, too close to the highway, things of that nature. And we don't want to see the public hurt, but the deer as well. Like an injured deer might go on a road, things of that nature. So, and that's a very busy highway. So that's just an example of where we kind of do our assessments. When we first got to Short Hills, we always knew there was a heavy, heavy deer population within the area due to the urbanization and some of the zoning bylaws that have been passed around here. But we knew there was a safe way for us to harvest within that area. So meeting with the guys back home and meeting with some of our chiefs and our clan mothers, we went forward to try meet with the province and set that as one of our traditional areas to get meat for ceremonies. Another thing, too, you got to realize, too, when the guys are out harvesting and the ladies, there's only a certain amount of deer that's available, right, for us specifically. Most of Southern Ontario has been turned into private property. We would have loved to see more parks within Southern Ontario, but that's not what happened with the Haudenosaunee lands. And the harvest area that we harvest in is very limited. And this opening up and being able to harvest within this area helped us get more land and access to the Duwahontes or the deer. It put a lot of weight off a lot of families because most families are struggling to get one or two, which they process in terms of the hide for their ceremonial outfits and food for their families for the year. But that extra weight with the guys who have to harvest, like myself, for the families that can't harvest. Like we have people who have on medicines, so they're not allowed to harvest because they have cultural reasons why they're not supposed to take deer. So those people have to be provided for. We also have families that don't have men that can harvest. Their men are older now, and some of those families ask us to bring them some deer as well. And then the last thing, I guess, is our ceremonies. That's the big thing, I guess, that usually we have five longhouses on the reserve with ceremonies throughout the year. And at our midwinters, which is around January, February, we have to usually get about 30 deer per longhouse, which adds up to quite a bit. So most of us guys, like myself, we would run out. Like we couldn't provide enough. So this actually gives us ample opportunity to provide the needed meat for our people for the year.
And can you tell me a little bit about why it happens at this time of year and generally how the day runs?
Yeah, most people don't think we have a season, but we do. It depends on the families, but I know a majority of our families go by the first frost, the killing frost. Some people go by the sumac, and some people go by the stars. The Big Dipper will turn, and that's when it goes with the story about the bear and the three hunters. I know myself, I usually wait for the first frost, the killing frost. We've chosen Short Hills at this time, one of two reasons. There's less people in the park because it's colder. We want them to be outside. Like we agree, as Haudenosaunee people should be outside getting exercise. I mean, that was kind of part of our culture, too, to be outside and doing things. And it's important to people to be out there. So we made that commitment as Haudenosaunee people to make sure we don't take away from the other people as well. But at the same time, we need to get our venison for harvest. I like the idea that you said harvest too, not hunted, because hunted has another connotation that we're out there to kill. And as a Haudenosaunee person growing up, we're in the hot. That's not something we're supposed to cherish or be very vocal about. It's a kind of really kind of a thing you keep low key. It's not something you celebrate.
And if the hunt was completely unimpeded, what would a normal day be like for the hunters as part of the harvest?
Well, in the morning, we usually meet early, and we get together, and we talk a little bit about what we're going to do for the day. We pick one of the younger guys who's kind of learning about our ceremonies, and we ask them to do an opening for us. And at that opening, we talk about all the different things on the earth that the Creator is providing for us. Like, we talk about the earth itself, how important it is. We talk about the people that we're still here together, the people that you are with. We talk about the water, how important it is. It washes and cleans the earth. We talk about the plants. We talk with the little plants first, like the grasses and stuff that the animals use. And then we talk about the berries and stuff that they use as well. It goes on, and we talk about like the bigger ones, like the trees, those sort of things that they clean our air. We knew a long time ago that was important, right? And then it warms us when we need a fire. And we talk about the animals, how important, even the small animals that swim, the ones that fly, the ones that walk. With all these things, we talk about one of them being the leader, right? And so, like with the berries, we talk about the strawberries. Like, that's our medicine for our people, right? And then with the animals, it's the deer, as we call Duwamutes, Uskunutu, Mohawk. But these are things within our culture that we want continued on, that these people continue. So this gentleman that we pick, he's learning it, and we try to encourage him to do as far as we can. If he can't continue or finish giving thanks, we ask somebody will be there with him and finish up for him if he can't, but usually he can. And at the end, we talk about how it's our job as people that we're there to come together and work together and have one mind, that it's important that we remember that our families back home depend on us, and we hope that we are safe for the day and that nobody gets hurt. Those sort of things. And that kind of ties in with our ideas about safety, right? And as the Haudenosaunee Wildlife and Habitat Authority, we'd already had gone in and kind of did a really good assessment that this is a good area. We're only going to use bows. We're not going to use rifles or anything of that nature. We're going to use kind of safe harvesting practices. It comes with the economics too, because when you're hunting with a bow, you have a $10 arrow, and then you have like a $30 tip on it, you're not going to be shooting all over the place. So you're going to make sure that if you're taking a shot at an animal, that it's going to be like a lethal one and very quick, right?
Over the years, you've had people who have protested the hunt. They don't believe in it for a number of reasons. They're concerned about safety. They're concerned about the animals. One of the issues that they've raised in the past is the issue of safety, and they claim that they have evidence over the years of bows that have gone astray or animals that have been wounded that have gone actually outside of the park to expire on private property. What's your response to that? And over the years, knowing that safety has been a primary concern right from the very beginning, have there been changes that you've had to make to accommodate or make it safer over a period of time?
Well, I know what the people that are against it, right? They don't really understand the culture significance of it. I have young men, I have young people that are working hard to uphold a lot of the cultural values when we're in the park. They're getting the exercise they need. They're harvesting for their family. So that's, to me, that's job one. When I look at people complaining about, and he can complain about anything, but we do talk with parks people and we have established protocols. Yes, you are going to get the odd deer that does wander off, but the parks people have been more than compliant in making sure that that deer has been recovered. And actually, when the deer get hit along the road, we take them too as well during that time. So we take them as well too, so that they're not just discarded or thrown to the dump. That's one thing I think we're very proud about, that our people, when we look at our relationship with the non-native community, right? Like our two-world wampum belt tells us that we have this obligation that we have to work with them. And teaching our young guys that this is part of that protocol, that if deer is wandering off, right, or outside the zone and it has been hit, that it's our job to make sure we retrieve it. And all of them pretty well have been retrieved. But like I said, we try to make our best to work together to make sure that all of them are retrieved, because they all are valuable to our people. We're not about to waste. That's not our way. And I think the thing about safety is it's paramount, especially when we have so many people involved with the harvest. They need to know what they're doing, and they do know what they're doing. That's one thing that we kind of stress over and over again. So,
there is another issue that has cropped up around safety, and that has to do with the barricades. Even people who follow the hunt may not really understand what's happening with traffic that's coming in to the harvest. So can you explain a little bit about what's going on there? They may not realize that the cars, the harvesters, are actually being stopped on the way in and being held. So who would like to address that? Michelle?
In regards to the barricade, initially CPT, Christian Peacemaker Teams, was brought out 4 years ago. And we were brought out because as the harvesters were trying to enter or exit the park, protesters were coming out surrounding the vehicles and there was physical altercations. And so CPT, as trained human rights and non-violent activists, we came out to get in the way, essentially to be able to create a buffer so that harvesters can stay safe, can exit and enter the park. Since that time, the police have gotten involved. And because Short Hills is closed for the harvest at all times, there are these wooden horses, wooden barricades at every entrance and exit. It's no longer the protesters that move the barricade. It's actually the police now that move the barricade. And so our role has transformed in a way to monitoring and getting in the way of the protesters with the harvesters, to monitoring the protesters as well as monitoring the police. What ends up happening with this barricade is, one, I would say a delay or violation of treaty rights. It is a treaty right that the harvester should be allowed to enter. It also creates a matter of safety where you have vehicles blocked up on a road at dawn and at dusk, the most dangerous time of day for people to be driving. We're actually having vehicles blocked on the road. And so there is an issue around that. One question is, what are they protesting and who are they protesting? From these protesters, I don't see a coordinated strategy in the Niagara region to protest settler hunters. Yet, when Indigenous people are using their treaty rights to harvest the deer, you suddenly get a coordinated strategy of protesters. Why is this happening? Why is this being allowed to happen? At the same time, I would also look at when they talk about, well, we are here for safety. Whose voices are we valuing when we talk about safety? As Chester has already mentioned, there are safety protocols, there are guidelines. Safety is extremely important to the harvesters. Of course it would be. They've been harvesting deer for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So why are folks valuing or engaging in non-hunters' rhetoric of what safety is, rather than listening to the voices of experience on the ground? At the same time, when we think about this barricade, I become frustrated because as CPT, all around the world, we stand in solidarity with Indigenous people. So going to protests and demonstrations is also part of our work. And nowhere have I seen where the police actually support the protesters and holding people up. An example of this is this coming Friday in Toronto, we have the monk debates going on, and you have Steve Bannon and David Frum taking part in a debate. And of course, there's going to be protesters, and there should be protesters. I cannot imagine the police enabling the protesters to stop the people from entering the debates 2 minutes, 3 minutes at a time, essentially setting up a checkpoint for folks to be allowed in. Rather, what they're going to do is they're going to push all the protesters aside to let people through. However, for me, this has other very real consequences that we need to think about. These are settler protesters that are actually setting up a barricade, delaying and inhibiting Indigenous people from accessing their treaty rights. That brings back memories of occupation, allowing settlers to set up a checkpoint to delay Indigenous people from accessing their rights. And I think at a time when Canada is talking about Bill C-262 and the importance of UNDRIP, why are we allowing settler protesters to set up a checkpoint to delay the access of Indigenous people from being able to access their treaty rights? And so those are some of the concerns I have about the barricade. just to keep in mind, at the website SixNationsRightToHunt.com, there is a petition that folks can sign. Already 1,400 people have signed the petition, and it is asking for the Niagara Regional Police to not allow for the barricade to exist. We've had conversations with the police before. Last year, I spoke on the phone with Sergeant Garner. He's talking about making sure to support the peace on both sides. But what we are actually asking for is also to support justice. And what does that justice look like?
Just to be clear, so people really understand where the barricade is, when you approach the entrance to the park from the road, the sawhorses, the wooden things, are blocking the entrance. So the vehicles have to come down the road, turn into Short Hills, and someone has to move that barricade to let them in. Is that correct?
Right when you pull into the driveway, they have those horses across there, and the protesters standing in front of them.
In front of the horses.
In front of them. So they're so close to our vehicles, right? They can touch them and bang them, and then as we pull in, they're taking pictures of us, and they're screaming at us, telling we're killers and things of that nature, right? So,
where are the police in all of this?
They're kind of standing off to the side, kind of keeping them back, I guess, to a certain extent. But to me, that's the main safety issue with Short Hills. Last year, I had 7 vehicles blocked up across the highway, and the police hadn't shut the road down. People were going around the vehicles, like a one lane. And if you've ever been toward the entrance of Short Hills, there's a curve right there, right? So vehicles have come whipped around there and slammed on just as the vehicles are parked across the road, because people who pass us, who don't go into the park, they pass to go to work. There's vehicles coming the other way, and so they've had to, like, just slam on, things of that nature. I mean, that's the most dangerous component to me as one of the harvesters. And the fact that they let them stand in front of our vehicles and taunt the people. I mean, our guys are pretty good, right? They don't say anything back, but that's ridiculous.
And who actually is physically moving the barricade to allow the vehicles through?
The OPP or the police do move the horses all the way and then let us go through one vehicle at a time. But they said they had a right to hold us for 5 minutes. But you get 4 or 5 vehicles piled up, you know, you're blocking the whole road way down the highway. And I don't know, it would just take, like, not touching the brake right to bump into them. Yeah, I'm hoping this year that changes. And when we leave, too, at the end of the day. There was a time when they would call us for 15 minutes. So I've got like 30 vehicles down there. So if each one of them got held for 30 minutes, we were getting out of there at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. And it's like takes us an hour to get there. So by the time we got done processing stuff, our guys would be up all night. And then how dangerous is that? The next day they'd be, you know, they're coming back, they're tired, they're driving. I mean, the danger is on us then, right, as harvesters, because we got to get back the next day. We try getting in the park early, so... Yeah, I think in a way they're endangering us on the road, and they're endangering us as we go home too, because we got to get back with our meat and we got to process it right away.
So the goal of the petition is to remove the barricades, or at least change how that process is being dealt with?
Christian Peacemaker teams, when we've been out there, we time the vehicles that are going through. And if you think about it, if one vehicle is only being held for 2 minutes, but you have a line of 10 vehicles, the last vehicle has to wait quite some time. And why is this happening? Why is this barricade allowed to exist? And while they're waiting, the harvesters have to be subject to racist settler harassment as well. Last year, the protesters, some of the signs that the protesters were carrying were end human privilege and end human supremacy. And this is playing off things like white privilege and white supremacy, terms that if you pay attention to politics in the U.S. this week, we should not be making light of these terms in any way, shape, or form. And so the question is, why does this barricade exist? Why is it being implemented by the police as well, when the right of the Indigenous folks is to be able to access the park?
Now, you mentioned that your involvement, your group's involvement over the years has been there to document, to witness, but also to try and help de-escalate in some ways. And so there are workshops that are happening this year, a number of workshops that are going to be happening on the site. There's quite a variety there. Could someone speak to those and what's going on?
So part of our role as CPT is to also encourage de-escalation. And the supporters of the hunt have done such an amazing job at providing educational initiatives. The supporters don't just show up in a counter-protest capacity. They show up striving to build relationships with everyone that is at the park, to engage in dialogue and also education. And this is something that I find really exciting. And especially this year, they put out a call for workshops for women and non-binary folks. And they were flooded with workshop activities, so much so that some have been put on the schedule for next year already. And these workshops are both to provide educational opportunities about settler colonialism, about indigenous rights, about treaties, about cultural appreciation, but also about international struggle around indigenous issues. And so this coming Saturday at 2 p.m., it will begin with a workshop around murdered and missing indigenous women. There's going to be an interactive art action in the afternoon at 4. Sunday, November 4th, there's going to be a workshop talking about settler colonialism from Turtle Island to Palestine. So bringing in theories, ideas, and concepts from folks that have been to Palestine and how they see similarities between what's happening here and what's happening in Palestine. And it just continues throughout the entire week. For those that are concerned about animal justice, animal liberation, there's going to be a workshop called Animal Liberation and Indigenous Justice. There's going to be a workshop with multiple faith communities talking about reconciliation. There's going to be faith leaders coming out talking about the importance of reconciliation and of Bill C-262. For those that want to learn more about anti-racism and decolonization, because I know it was brought up today in this interview, Sunday the 18th, there will be one specifically a workshop on anti-racism and decolonization. So you can go to the website. There's a full list of all the workshops. And then there's a concluding feast and film screening on December 1st at 1 p.m. that all folks should come and check out. And so we are really excited as an organization to be able to support this action, because it's not just about counter-protest. It's not just about monitoring. It is also about, at least for us, it's about learning ways that we can get involved in educating folks around these issues.
And the workshops are being held outdoors, so they should dress warmly.
The workshops are being held outdoors. Dress warmly. There will be a fire folks can sit around. If there's rain, there will be a tarp. But it's also a really fun place to learn about these issues outside, by a fire, engaging in an informal discussion. It really provides a safe space for people to come and learn about these issues and ask questions.
And Chester, what's your hope for this year's hunt?
I think when we first were looking at getting out to Short Hills and doing some harvesting out there, the bigger picture is that Haudenosaunee people have to reclaim some of our rights. We want to hold on to a lot of our cultural activities. The idea was that not only would there be education on the other side, as our two-row wampum belt tells us, right? Like, you guys are in your ship, we're in our canoe. But in our canoe, as a Haudenosaunee and an indigenous person, we have the right to these things, but there's responsibilities. Just like when I talked about that at Ganohono, that young person gives in the morning, all these different things have a responsibility to the earth so that we continue. And it's no different for our people. We teach them that these responsibilities that even working with the park people, working with Rochelle and working with Brock, that's our obligation. And trying to get our people to realize that in order for us to move forward and hold on to those cultural activities and hold on to our language and these sort of things, we have to work together. It doesn't go alone. We have to work together with each other. So I think that's the bigger picture. We both got work to do. And we're trying to do it on our end, and it's obviously picking up momentum on the other end, which we appreciate. Yeah.
We've been speaking with Chester Gibson. He is a master student at Brock University, a coordinator of the Harvest out at Short Hills, and a representative of the Haudenosaunee Wildlife and Habitat Authority, and Rochelle Friesen, who is the Canadian coordinator of Christian Peacemaker Teams. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.